Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Donald Trump became the nation's 45th president on Friday. Already there's a dust-up with the media, this time over the number of inaugural attendees. Trump Press Secretary Sean Spicer kicked off the conflict when he accused the media of erroneously reporting that fewer people were on hand for Trump's inauguration than Barack Obama's inauguration.
This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period, both in person and around the globe. Even the New York Times printed a photograph showing that a misrepresentation of the crowd in the original tweet in their paper, which showed the full extent of the support, depth, and crowd and intensity that existed. These attempts to lessen the enthusiasm of the inauguration are shameful and wrong.
The press conference lasted about 5 minutes. No questions were taken. We'll get to that and more during our weekly reporters roundtable today. Joining me in the studio, Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs Editor Darryl Roland. Welcome back.
Good morning, Ann. Your first show of the Trump era.
It's the first show of the Trump era, right. And reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Andy Chow. Welcome back and happy birthday, Andy.
Hi, thanks.
Coming up in a few minutes, we'll be joined by Columbus Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Chrissy Thompson. So, right off the bat, I mean, I think someone made the point, Darryl Roland, that it was literally the first thing the new press secretary said to the press at the first press conference, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it was sort of like the complete, absolute beginning of what?
Yeah, is this? We're all wondering, is this setting the new tone? And indeed, I think Kellyanne Conway mentioned that it's fine if the press holds President Trump accountable, they plan on holding the press accountable, which is all well and good. That's fine. But what was it? I think is credited to the late Senator Daniel Moynihan about you're entitled to your own opinion. You're not entitled to your own facts.
And apparently they want to do that, too.
Well, we're in this surreal world already where the Trump administration is telling like Chuck Todd on NBC yesterday about we have alternate facts.
Alternative facts.
Yeah,
right?
Alternative facts. Yes, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, what I've heard of alternative universes, things like that. Maybe that's what we're entering now. Look at the pictures and judge for yourselves. I mean, this is not something, and as you know, crowd counts, especially beyond a certain size, they're impossible to gauge.
Well, they're never absolutely precise. Right. It's always, but there are strategies. There are ways to do it. How many people use the mass transit system, for instance, is a common way the police measure it in Washington, D.C. for these events.
Right. And again, just look at the pictures, presuming they're taken at comparable times of comparable spots, which is my understanding. Mr. Spicer is talking about the covering on the ground where it made it look more like there were not people for Trump. I don't know. Somehow that made a difference. I never did quite understand it. I guess that's maybe obvious from my stumbling here. But it's like, just look at the pictures. There were people in this one. There are no people in this one in the same spots. And why is this such a freaking big deal anyhow?
Well, it is a big deal. It's literally the first thing he brought up at the press conference. What did you make of it, Andy Chow?
Well, I think kind of going off of what Darryl says, the idea of how big of a crowd is at something has been something that has driven Donald Trump crazy ever since he started running for president. It's something that he used to bring up constantly at these political rallies. While he was speaking to his crowd of supporters, he would always stop and say, and by the way, these cameras here, they need to zoom out and show the whole crowd. They always show me. They never show the whole crowd. He always got upset about the idea of the size of a crowd being misrepresented. And if you go back and look at their old tweets, he would send out a wide shot of an arena and say, look at the crowd. And then another person would show that a wider shot of the arena where there's actually a lot of empty seats. And then again, the campaign would get really upset about it. The idea of crowd size has always been something that's really stuck in Donald Trump's craw for a while now. And it's just the thing that I think we've all been wondering is what's going to be the difference between Donald Trump, the candidate, Donald Trump, the president-elect, and now Donald Trump, the president. And the fact that this is still one of these little petty, I don't want to, maybe not petty, but these issues that kind of seem pretty petty, the fact that we're talking about this a little bit after the inauguration is just kind of bizarre to me.
I want to just add one more category onto Donald Trump, and that would be Donald Trump, the television reality show star, Chrissy Thompson. It seems like a lot of his, interest in these kinds of numbers stem from maybe that validation that something's working if you count how many people are there and...
Sure, from ratings or,
ratings,
or things
yeah,
like
I guess,
that.
Yeah,
yeah, you know, that may be true. He definitely is different than any president we've ever had. And, you know, a lot of politicians do care a lot about their media coverage, but know that they shouldn't so much. And a lot of them try not to read what's written about them. A lot of them get specific briefings from their PR people that show them the coverage that they think that they should care about and maybe massage a little bit. Maybe they're not showing them things that they think are unfair or that would upset them or, you know, I mean, that's just a reality. So Donald Trump consumes this stuff himself, always has, you know, used to spend all his time on his plane in between stops, you know, watching the media coverage and assessing it himself. Would get upset when he saw things and occasionally just call in to television shows, you know, during his campaign. So it's definitely something that I think has, I'm going to use the word plagued, has plagued his last couple of campaigns, this is preoccupation. And when you're the leader of the free world, you need to be above this sort of thing a little bit so that you can direct the country with a clear head, I think.
There was a moment with Chuck Todd in his conversation with Kellyanne Conway on Sunday on Meet the Press, Daryl Roland, where she said, well, now I can see where you're coming from, and I guess this is the way it's going to be. And I wasn't quite sure what she was talking about. What are we saying about all this? What does it mean as far as the relationship between an administration, any administration in the press? How important is it?
Well, I think that was in the section where she was talking about making this accountability a two-way street, where the Trump administration, and you know, in addition to keeping us all safe from terrorists and running the free world, are also going to keep tabs on the press as well. And like I say, that's all well and good. We have been to numerous events here just in Ohio where I don't know how to say it, folks. If you love Trump, God love you, but Mr. Trump, President Trump, lied. He talked about at his Columbus airport, people lined up outside. There were no people lined up outside. And in fact, when he said those words, there were more people leaving, going out, than there were coming in. In Cincinnati, at the, I think it's called U.S. Bank Arena now. Again, he talked about the huge crowds waiting outside, couldn't get in. I was outside. There were no crowds. There were about 50 protesters across the street and a few people milling around. It was not true.
When we were at the Columbus Convention Center, there another example of that where President Trump said that the crowd was, I believe he said something like 15,000. It was something way above what the capacity of that arena could have even held. The fire marshals would have been put in jail for allowing as many people as what Trump was saying were in there. And again, this is just a theme. This is something that's always been something that the Trump campaign has pushed out there.
And then he was critical of the fire
That's
marshal.
Right. Yeah, the second time around. Yeah, the second time
they
around, he was critical of the fire marshal. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that it's important. You asked about what does Kellyanne Conway mean by this? So I see what kind of relationship we're going to have. And Gregory Cordy, who covers the White House for USA Today, which is one of our news partners, he posted on Facebook this weekend. I thought it was a really, really good point. And he said, you know what? No one who's covering the White House has gotten here without dealing with hostile public relations people, hostile political operatives. And thank you all for your kind words, but we're going to be fine. And honestly, I think that's really important for us to point out. I think we can objectively say what was going on with the crowds this weekend. And, you know, Jake Tapper said that Kellyanne Conway wasn't answering the question and was spreading falsehoods. I think that's true. However, I don't think this needs to be this big, personally, I don't think this needs to be this big dramatic,
well,
you know.
In and of itself is not what I'm particularly interested in. I'm interested in the larger issue of the relationship between a presidential administration and the press. Like when they say they're thinking about moving the press out of the West Wing, mm-hmm. for example, what does that matter that they're not there? They already don't let them fly with them and go places with them.
Honestly, I think limiting access sometimes makes reporters better. I've experienced limited access covering campaigns. A recent campaign I covered, I was denied access to certain press calls that everyone else was allowed to have. And honestly, I think it puts you on your toes, makes you focus more on accountability. And so if access allows us to see what's going on, get to know people better, and do our jobs better, but it also is a hindrance in that it makes you feel more
beholden, kind of a thing.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, this is just my opinion, but if they mm-hmm. want to take the press out of the West Wing, I'm sure they'll still be able to do their jobs.
Now, reporters have sparred with, you know, press secretaries and public offices before, and we're used to that sort of tension between the offices and then us as the journalists. But I think that the danger here is that, and what the Trump campaign and now what the Trump administration has done before, is that they bring the people into it. They bring just the citizens, the constituents into it, and try to turn the constituents or the supporters against journalists, and try to make the American people question the integrity of journalists. And we don't see that in the normal sparring between public offices and journalists. It's usually us between them behind closed doors. We figure things out.
Right.
I think the danger is the Trump administration's trying to get public support their way and public anger against journalism. And that's been another common theme. And I think that's very dangerous to send their supporters to attack journalism.
I agree with that. That's a fair point. It is a little different than what we typically encounter.
Hmm. Yeah, well, two things. And both Christy and Andy's points about, you know, these skirmishes take part all the time. I remember a very, very bitter skirmish between one of colleagues to both Ann and me, the Dispatch, Joe Hallett, our now retired senior editor, mm-hmm. had with the Obama campaign about a crowd count in, off the top of my head, I think it was Northwest Ohio. And it was crazy. And, you know, frankly, as a very young and fairly inexperienced press aide trying to call out one of the most senior reporters in Ohio. Now, this was all done in phone calls and emails. There was no
public demonstration of it.
There was no attempt to say, you know, Joe Hallett's this awful biased reporter and all this. The other point is, have you ever been in that warren of press offices, especially down, you know, in the basement level in the White House? I mean, that's getting kicked out of there may be a favor. I don't know. And, of course, the press room itself is over the old swimming pool. Mm-hmm. The Nixon put a floor over, so I don't know if they're bringing that back or what. Yeah, from a practical, again, I've never worked in Washington full time. My understanding is about the only real detriment might be at some of those press events, you can kind of walk down the hall and maybe catch some White House aides and, you know, sort of talk to them on the side. That can be valuable for source development. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Kennedy held all his press events in, what, the State Department or something like that. And my goodness, everything is now so connected and interconnected. It's not going to affect things. So I think that's more of a, as they, with apologies to Monty Python, a flesh wound, if you will. The effort to delegitimize a free press, if that is what is taking place, you know, we're just day three of the administration or whatever. I think that is a real danger. First of all, it gets us talking about this for all these minutes, and we're
instead
not talking about the nominees.
The policies,
and,
but it's what,
and, yeah. So... Yeah,
because if you delegitimize the journalism, then nobody's going to trust you when you're reporting on, oh, by the way, here's an executive order that President Trump signed to try to roll back the Affordable Care Act, and here's a thing he signed. Mm-hmm. If you take away that trust, then nobody's going to even pay attention to the reporting that you do on the policy.
To the most basic reporting. We are talking about the new Trump presidential administration. We welcome calls. We just want them to be civil, one way or the other. Give us a call if you have a question or comment. as long as you aren't screaming. We want to hear what you have to say. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Real estate mogul Donald Trump ran a presidential campaign unlike any other. And on Friday, he gave an inaugural address unlike any before, directly criticizing the leaders in Washington, many of whom were sitting behind him at the inauguration at that moment.
The establishment protected itself, but not the citizens of our country. Their victories have not been your victories. Their triumphs have not been your triumphs. That all changes starting right here and right now, because this moment is your moment. It belongs to you.
We're following up today on our weekly reporters roundtable. Still with us, Cincinnati Inquirer, Columbus Bureau Chief Chrissy Thompson, Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs Editor Daryl Rowland, and Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau Reporter Andy Chow. Once again, questions or comments? Civility is always the order of the day, so we welcome them. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Trump's inaugural speech was, it's been said many times already, a clear populist message. He also made mention of America First, America First, those kinds of references that have been linked to white nationalist organizations, the alt-right, racist organizations, that kind of a thing. By now, it's been well documented that America First has that tone to it, and yet he still uses it. Chrissy Thompson, he did it a lot on the campaign trail as well, right?
Yeah, I think this is what we expected of this president. I am curious to see, especially as his cabinet nominations are moving through the process for confirmation hearings. We're seeing some of these folks. Nikki Haley is one that I thought of. She's his nominee for ambassador to the United Nations. And really, she said, my goal is to make the case to the president that why we need the United Nations. So that's just an example. I'm really looking to see whether some of these Republicans who are in power in the legislature and some of Trump's own cabinet members, if they are approved, if they steer this this policy into a different direction than what we may see. We didn't get a lot of details. That wasn't the purpose of the speech on Friday. We didn't get a lot of details, and we haven't gotten a lot of details from Donald Trump. What do you mean exactly by America First? He said he's going to put border taxes on people. He said that this morning. If they move jobs, across the border to Mexico, for instance. But how will that play out? What are the specifics? And we don't really know. So I think it's an interesting time to see what's going to happen. Rhetoric has to turn to policy now, and I don't. And he's not in charge of everything. We have multiple branches of our government. So I'm really interested to see how it plays out.
Barack Obama well found out and all of his predecessors before him. Let's take a couple calls. Tom in Dublin, you're on the air. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, in these tumultuous times that we've been living in, we've had a war going on since 2003, March 19th. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, there's a lot of agent provocateurs out there. There's a lot of agents of change that want to bring up issues, but they're just causing trouble. I'll give you an example. With a woman's march, if there's such an outcry for abortion, there should be a bigger outcry for a war against pornography. Something to think about.
Okay.
There's there's those, we're supposed to form a more perfect union, so we have to get together. We shouldn't, you know, if Lisa Cerrone, a.k.a. Madonna, goes and spews in front of a bunch of people, she's probably getting paid for that. She's not doing that as an American citizen just out of, you know, the kindness of her heart. You know, people have to look behind this smoked glass lens.
Well, I don't know. Was she paid or not? I don't know that.
Well,
do you know?
As a journalist, somebody should find out and you know, put that in
okay.
as well. Because these things, when you see large groups of protesters and then finely printed signs, somebody's printing those signs. That's expensive to print 16 by 20 signs.
Okay.
So, you know, the American people need to, and the journalists are real journalists, because journalism, as you all know, isn't the same as it used to be 15, 20 years ago. You know, everybody's speaking too much, and there's so many uncredentialed journalists. So our journalists who are, work with, like, the Dispatch, the Inquirer, up there north, the Plain Dealer, they need to be not scared of really getting and sinking their teeth and their pens and their papers and all their notes in the really stories that cut. And it takes a long time to do that, because okay. you know, now we have journalism that's so fast.
Oh, yeah. Well, mm-hmm. Tom, thanks a lot for that call. We appreciate it. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. He kind of echoed a little bit about what you guys were saying, or what you were saying. Chrissy Thompson, just nose to the grindstone and just move on, get on with it.
Yeah, I think that we have an opportunity as reporters to focus on accountability journalism of all sides in a way that we maybe have never had quite a moment where our role is so much in the spotlight. So I sort of feel like let's show them what we do. Let's do good work.
And I think you're all, there's a lot of scrutiny into, all right, people are going to have their eyes open on what is fake journalism or not so quite legitimate journalism compared to true legitimate journalism. And I think everybody's under a big microscope when it comes to that too.
And that's fake journalism or fake news has sort of become, I guess, the cliche of 2017. Mm-hmm. And it can't be, you just disagree with something and thus it's fake news, you know? On the other hand, I'm certainly not saying journalists are faultless here, and we have not all stumbled or fallen short or not made the extra phone call. Lord knows we're all suffering from budget cuts. It affects everything we do. There was a little detail over the weekend. First of all, the press pool was allowed to travel with President Trump after the inaugural through the various balls and all that. I shouldn't say with, in the same motorcade,
yeah.
And they were allowed in. They could almost hear. And there was a minor error at one point by the pool reporter. And we have pool reporters because you can't fit 50 journalists into some of these venues. For mm-hmm. instance, this was at the edge of the Oval Office. And he talked about the new decor. There's, you know, gold curtains instead of crimson ones. And the Churchill and Teddy Roosevelt bust is back. And he mentioned, and I got it right here in front of me, apart from the return of the Churchill bust, the MLK bus, Martin Luther King bus, was no longer on display. He sent that out in the pool report. And again, that he is our eyes and ears. That's what a pool reporter is. That was an inaccuracy, as it turns out. Now, to his credit, that was corrected, I don't know, within minutes, but very short time, certainly that evening, mm-hmm. And well before the end of the evening. But yet this is being held up as an example of fake news, of bias. And it seems more like a stumble, but it does show it is very incumbent on those of us in the press to, you know, we better make sure our act is together. The old pointing your finger at somebody else, you know, you better have your own act together, too.
Email from Mark says, the very fact that your panelists spent 20 minutes without once mentioning the huge women's rallies on Saturday means that the Trump strategy of distracting the press with crowd size and unimportant stories is winning. Interesting. I mean, I was going to bring up the, I mean, it's, I get that, what he's saying. It was, they were huge rallies across the country, around the world, actually. the question. I mean, there was a lot of questions about whether they were protests or for women or against Trump, that kind of a thing. A lot of semantics going on, semantic hair splitting.
I like to use the word demonstrations when it's not a clear protest.
Demonstration.
Little style tip there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. I mean, is that, do you think they were strategizing that carefully?
Who's they?
The Trump people?
Trump administration to distract people?
Well, I just think it's
that's what
I mean,
do. That's
what I mentioned before. We're talking about these controversies that in the long run really don't mean anything except maybe for this effort to discredit any independent oversight. We're not talking about that. But that's been a continuation seemingly of strategy from the campaign trail. So,
I think,
you know, it's on us if we let that do it, you know, if we let that happen too much.
I think the emailer forgets that we did at the beginning talk about how the size was in the photos, et cetera, just in the Washington events. There were more people, apparently, on the mall for the Women's March. I mean, it was readily apparent. It was really all these gatherings across the country. There was tons of coverage of them.
Yeah.
You could argue the inauguration was on a Friday, and those were on a Saturday. So Sunday papers across the country had quite a bit of coverage of that. That was something we talked about. Actually, the Inquirer, we had so much inauguration coverage that we did hold a little bit of it for Sunday because some of our folks only get the Sunday paper. So we wanted to be able to have coverage of both in that edition. So, I think for people who care, as a reporter, you're not allowed to take sides per se, but I do care a lot about people just taking action on any side. And it was heartwarming to see not only folks who came out to celebrate the transition of power, but also so many women, you know, they were marching for a variety of different causes. It really wasn't any one unified reason. And everybody had a different point of view, and I think it was really cool to see.
What's going to be interesting is that we did see a huge amount of people turn out all around the country for these women's marches. And but like we're saying, there was not one – not exactly one common goal out there. And so in the next 2 years leading up to the midterms, will those groups be able to sort of focus in on what they want to accomplish and rally the support that is obviously out there in some way and make that manifest itself into votes for certain candidates? And I think that's going to be the big challenge for a lot of organizers to see, okay, there's obviously anger out there or passion out there for certain causes. How can we harness that in a way to get them to vote for our candidate? And because obviously it didn't quite end up that way in November. I mean, the popular vote would say otherwise, but electorally it didn't turn out that way in November. So there's a lot of people out there with a lot of opinions who want something to happen, who want something to change. How do you get that to end up in election results?
Yeah, to Andy's point, I mean, I wrote countless stories and talked to countless people who were the kind of people who would support Hillary Clinton and did hope that she would become president and decided not to vote because they didn't really like her that much. She didn't excite them enough to get out and vote. And I would be shocked if every single woman who turned out at the women's rallies on Saturday had turned out to vote for her. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Janet in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Janet.
Hi. Hello, people. I wanted to say that I really appreciate you talking about this otherwise inconsequential debate about the number of people in the crowds and the audience, because while I do concede that it is a distraction, and I'm afraid I do think that Mr. Trump and his administration are throwing a lot of distractions at the American people, I think this is a crucial one right at the beginning here. Because what I'm afraid of is the effect that it has on the consumers of journalism. I know it'll have effects on the journalists themselves, and I hope that they're good effects, causing them to be, you know, really buckle down and get to work. But I'm afraid that people who are listening to any form of news or what's talked about will pretty much start to get inured, if you will, to the idea that, well, we don't really know. He said, they said, whatever. And for example, One, it's one thing to debate about something fairly meaningless like the size of the crowd, but if an administration at any point were to start telling us something like, we need to impose martial law in, say, for example, Philadelphia, because this is what happened there, and people no longer feel that they can find out what really happened there, then we have gone down to a very dangerous place. I'm afraid, do you see what I'm saying? That that how people...
Who cares about how many people were at the inauguration, but what if they're the alternative truth or alternative facts start to take on more consequential issues? Yeah, Janet, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's I think it's very well put. And again, you hesitate right at the front end of an administration to paint these apocalyptic scenarios. But that's why I say, if this is going to be the MO, if it's just going to be kind of campaign mode on, I mean, how does a democracy function? You know, we're just, in theory, at least, you're supposed to have this reasoned debate and compromises and trade-offs. But at its base, there is a fairly widespread agreement on what the facts are. You know, you may have, and indeed do have, differing opinions on how to attack a problem or address a problem. But if you can't even agree on the facts, I don't know. It leads to despotism. And yeah, my way is the only truth. And that's why some people, I think, were really frightened. It's almost a remark that didn't get that much attention in Cleveland. Trump talked about when he had his acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention, he talked about only I can, you know, solve these problems, because only I. And if this is going to be the model where we just have one, essentially, arbiter of not only what's the best policy, but what the facts are, what the truth is, boy, that's a different model than I think America has ever seen.
Mm-hmm. All right, Janet, thanks a lot for that call. And then one quick comment from David in Worthington. You're on the air. Hi, David.
Hello. I do appreciate this topic. I wish we had done it, half a year ago, a year ago. I do think the panel needs to address their actions, like a prior caller commented. I think the press in general are largely responsible for this guy being elected and now threatening our way of life and government. I think that the press need to ignore, largely ignore, and give little time to his distractions, and focus on the consequences of his actions. So I hope you, the press in general, and you guys evaluate your past performance, learn from it, and definitely you guys change.
So what the caller's talking about, I think I'm going to fill in some blanks for him, is the control of news cycles by whatever crazy thing Donald Trump had just said at the rally that he had, you know, and he had these rallies kind of spaced out to hit these news cycles. It was a smart strategy. And I just would say there is soul searching going on throughout journalism about that. I don't think not for the reason that journalists, you know, wish that he hadn't been elected. But we saw something different in this campaign than we'd ever seen before. And it did result in some lopsided coverage at times. And that's something that needs to be kind of thought about.
I just would add that be careful to fall into what David was saying and what you hear a lot from the alt-right, which is the press did this, the press did that. The press is a huge holistic, big group of people that splits up into a whole bunch of different branches. There are radio reporters, print reporters, TV reporters. There's cable news outlets, local news outlets. If you looked at cable news, I would say, yes, cable news focused a lot on Donald Trump in the primary, helped him out a lot, gave him a lot of coverage. You can't just say the press and put everybody into one box and say, that's the press, that's what they did. And I think we all have to be a little bit smarter about that, because we are entering a world where journalists are coming under attack for a lot of reasons. So we're entering a world where we're talking about a lot of complex issues. So let's narrow things down. And if we're talking about cable news, let's say cable news. If we're talking about local newspapers or local public radio stations, let's specify what we're talking about.
We're going to take a quick break and continue our conversation. It's our weekly Reporters Roundtable. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The nation has a new president, Donald J. Trump. We're talking about presidential politics this hour on our weekly Reporters Roundtable. Still with us, Cincinnati Enquirer, Columbus Bureau Chief Chrissy Thompson, Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs Editor Daryl Rowland, and Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. We're still looking to see if Madonna was paid to address the hundreds of thousands of people at the Women's March in Washington. I guess the same thing would go for Beyonce and Ashley Judd and all kinds of people that were there. Gloria Steinem, you name it. They were there over the weekend. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I did want to move on a little bit and talk about what's going on at the State House and Governor Kasich in particular. Donald Trump has signed an executive order giving agencies involved in the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, the authority to pull back on certain regulations. We're not sure exactly what that's going to be at this point, what they're talking about. I'm sure there are journalists around the country working on that right now, trying to figure out who has the authority to do what. But Ohio Governor John Kasich traveled to Washington, wrote a letter to lawmakers saying that they should replace Obamacare with the Ohio plan. And I'm wondering, Daryl Rowland, what's the Ohio plan? Isn't that Obamacare with the Medicaid expansion? I don't get it.
Well, it's intriguing. And that was one of the tweets after our story appeared on that in Thursday's paper and online, the Ohio Democratic Party spokeswoman tweeted out, "Well, so it's just Obamacare without the name." Not quite. It does. What draws the contrast, I think, between Governor Kasich and a lot of his Republican colleagues is that Kasich is not shying away from several of those aspects of Obamacare. Most well-known is indeed, as you said, the Medicaid expansion here in Ohio, which has covered 700,000 people who did not have health insurance before. So he wants to keep that. The Obamacare exchanges have added another, in round numbers, 300,000. So that's a million people who have insurance in Ohio that did not before. Many of those are the mentally ill. Many of those are veterans and their families. Folks that probably no Republican, hardly any Republican, wants to cut. So he goes to Washington. Let's make the case for that. But Ohio's also implemented essentially managed care in Medicaid, and they've really been able to hold the cost down. Now, no one is cutting the cost, but we're going from double-digit increases to low to mid-single-digit increases. And that's on the campaign trail when he's running for president. That was Governor Kasich's main critique of Obamacare, if you will, as it did not fulfill its promise to hold costs down. So he's proposing a way to sort of keep you know, to thread that needle, the Republicans challenge to get rid of Obamacare, but yet keep the goodies. You know, and it's like we want to throw out the vegetables and keep the desserts. It doesn't work too well. So that's his plan. Whether he has the wherewithal to push that, whether he's just so marginalized himself in the era of Donald Trump, they won't even listen to him. I don't know. I guess we're going to find out.
Yeah, you know, this is something that I worked on quite a bit when Kasich was running for president. Back in 2015, I spent like almost a month trying to get him to say what he would do with if he repealed Obamacare as president. And I basically, you know, little bits and pieces here, he said to me once, like, this question again. And he just, like, said something different every time. So I was trying to put it all together. It basically came down to that he believed basically in keeping Medicaid, block granting money to the states. So he wants states to be in charge of what they do. And, you know, keeping people on their insurance until they turn, you know, pre-existing conditions until they turn 26, that kind of thing. But that the other goals of Obamacare, such as the personal mandate, which was originally a conservative principle, that he thought that
you
there would other...
You have to either be insured one way or another.
That's right.
Or sign
or
up
pay
for
a fine.
Obamacare.
Yeah.
This is the basic premise, though, of insurance.
Right. So he...
this
but it's
isn't
interesting.
Like they had to do that.
Interesting, though, because he and many Republicans now have kind of taken this tone he would find some way to get people to stay covered without mandating it, is what he kept saying. Some sort of incentive working with... hospitals, he talks about a lot, working with hospitals. But anyway, it was basically Obamacare without some of the mandates, but wanted to have the same effects, essentially. And he thought he could negotiate that with the private sector. So it was as confusing then as it is now.
And I think there's a lot of people, Democrats and Republicans, who would agree that there are changes that need to be made to the Affordable Care Act because prices are going up.
Yeah, exactly.
That's always been assumed there would be changes.
And so taking a step out and just looking at the whole issue politically, I think Republicans have a tough role now because everybody's like, okay, you said you wanted to repeal and replace it. Now's your chance, and now there's a lot of burden on them to be able to do it, fix it, and be able to tout that for, again, when midterms come up in 2 years. So the thing that's going to be interesting is, and kind of like what you said, are they just going to make some changes, but it's basically still going to be the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare? It's just not going to have the same name. I think one issue that a lot of people are going to be keeping a close eye on and that affects a lot of people in Ohio is how whatever changes will impact small businesses, because small businesses are an entity out there that are getting hit hard by what the Affordable Care Act prices are doing because they're having a hard time affording it. They're paying a lot to be able to provide insurance to their employees. That's something that Governor Kasich's plan talks about a lot, is trying to help small businesses. And that's something that the House Republicans have said. It's just a matter of how do you do that? How do you help small businesses in this way?
George in Perrysville, you're on the air. Hi, George.
Yeah, hi. First of all, I wanted to say, you know, I'm a Democrat, but I have a lot of respect for what our governor had done and what he couldn't do. He just couldn't go along with the hate that he saw trumpeted. I also attended with my wife a Women's March here in Worcester, and one of the signs I saw the most often was, "Don't do away with my health care. I need my health care." As a matter of fact, we have a neighbor who, without Obamacare, would have been in deep trouble because of an operation she recently had to have. So I guess what the president said as he was leaving office was, as far as Obamacare, if you have something better, great, but don't just dump this. And that's, you know, one of the things I saw most often on signs when we're at the Women's March. One of the most moving was this sweet little older lady in a wheelchair, as a matter of fact, that was holding a little sign that says, "Now you've tipped Grandma off." Mm-hmm. we can't do away with this. We can't do away with this. We people need health care. Sure, it can be tweaked, but sometimes just using the term Obamacare, people, on the extreme right go, okay, well, it must be evil, wicked, bad, nasty. We need to do away with it. Mm. But we'd be in bad shape without it.
Thanks, George, for your call. Rob in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Hi, Rob.
Hello, how are you doing? I've got a question for you, the people on your panel. I was wanting to know, with the signature of the executive order, if it eliminates the personal mandate, because before the whole inauguration, I was watching some news outlets, and they were talking about the president has some power to strip certain things away, but they need Congress, and the mandates is some of the things that they said that the president could strip away without Congress.
Yeah, as far as I know, the executive order was very, very general. It's a great question, Rob. The executive order was very, very general, and so it didn't actually specifically do much. So I would say if you're wondering, for instance, if you still need to be covered as of right now, the answer, I believe, is yes. Mm-hmm. So and my fellow panelists here are nodding. I think that executive order was mostly symbolic, and we're going to have to wait to see what actually happens.
Yeah, the executive order sends a message throughout the Trump administration of how to handle carrying out the Affordable Care Act, and I believe part of the executive order says to bring down costs. So when you're going about your daily routine of carrying out the Affordable Care Act, look for a way of cutting costs. Look for a way of making it cheaper for everybody involved. Along those sort of lines.
Cutting out the personal mandate, that is the requirement that you either have to be covered by insurance through work or some other way, or you have to go through the Affordable Care Act / Obamacare, so there's no confusion about what we're talking about. It's the same thing. The idea of the personal mandate is is the basis of managing the costs of of the Affordable Care Act. If half the people decide they don't want to sign up for it, we don't have the foundation for covering it.
Well,
this is not debatable.
That was one of the things in Governor Kasich's 4-page letter. I mean, I was there and Chrissy tried to every couple of months to get details. And I just said, well, there you go again. Yeah. Nice try. But eventually she filled up at least a couple of notebook pages over a few
pages. It was the ACA notebook. Yeah.
Something like that. But the governor sees the flaw as, okay, you have the individual mandate, which is not very good, but then you have subsidies to lowered the cost on individuals who have to buy insurance now, and then you have to increase taxes to pay for the subsidies for the individual mandates. And he just sees that part as a bit of a, Rube Goldberg contraption. And I bet the Obama administration would not disagree. That's that's why this nut has not been cracked before. It's between, delivering good quality health care and paying for the freaking thing in a way that America will go for. That's not an easy thing. So that was Obama's try, as the caller from Perrysville, about 5 miles from where I grew up, by the way, pointed out. The former President Obama said, "Hey, if you can make it better, do it." I don't think he's adverse to that. You do have these fundamental misunderstandings, even in this day and age. We do hear, "Well, I don't care if Obamacare goes away because I still got that Affordable Care Act." People, it's the same thing. And it reminds me back in 2010 during the health care debate. It wasn't just Sarah Palin and the death panels. It was members of the public saying, keep your government out of my Medicare. It's like, yeah that is a government health care program, folks. So it's like, we need to get up to speed. Like I say, we talked about this truth. We need to have some facts if we're going to have an intelligent, rational discussion in this country. It's supposed to be what democracy is all about. That falls apart.
And it's
welcome to Monday morning, but the end of the world is nigh.
Yeah.
And
well, it's what this show's all about. We've had many programs on the Affordable Care Act / Obamacare. We will have many, many more as the efforts to repeal it get underway. I want to thank my everlasting panel of reporters once again this week. Daryl Rowland, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ann. Always a pleasure.
Chrissy Thompson from the Cincinnati Enquirer, you as well.
Thank you.
And Andy Chow, happy birthday from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks to all of you. Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.